This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Ondaatje, is best known for his novel, The English Patient. It won the Booker Prize. The movie adaptation swept the Academy Awards. Ondaatje grew up in Sri Lanka, an island off the southeast tip of India. He was born in 1943, when the island was called Ceylon and was still a British colony. He has idyllic memories of his early childhood, but Sri Lanka is now torn apart by a civil war in which the guerrilla army, the Tamil Tigers, is fighting to secede. Ondaatje's new novel, Anil's Ghost, is set in the late 80s when the war took on a different form. Separatists and anti-government insurgents declared war on the government, and the government responded with hit squads. The main character, Anil, grew up in Sri Lanka and is now a forensics expert who works in America with the UN. She sent back to Sri Lanka on a human rights mission to analyze the remains of corpses and skeletons and investigate whether they were the victims of state-sponsored murder. In this scene, she's thinking about war and death as she begins work on a recently discovered skeleton.
In a fearful nation, public sorrow was stamped down by the climate of uncertainty. If a father protested a son's death, it was feared another family member would be killed. If people you knew disappeared, there was a chance they might stay alive if you did not cause trouble. This was the scarring psychosis in the country. Death, loss was unfinished, so he could not walk through it. There had been years of night visitations, kidnappings or murders in broad daylight. The only chance was that the creatures who fought would consume themselves. All that was left of law was a belief in an eventual revenge towards those who had power. And who was the skeleton? In this room among these four, she was hiding among the unhistorical dead. Who was he, this representative of all those lost voices? To give him a name would name the rest.
It's Michael Ondaatje reading from his new novel, Anil's Ghost. Why did you want to make a forensic anthropologist the main character of a novel?
Well, I think... What I wanted to do was write about a place where terrible murders committed against people in the present, and also to write about a place that had an ancient history. So what I wanted to do was really combine two professions to try and talk about this. One was to have a forensic specialist like Anil, who comes back to Sri Lanka and investigates some of these crimes, and also team up with an archaeologist who would allow me and the book to kind of deal with a much more ancient history of the place, not just make it a contemporary snapshot.
Some of the things you had to imagine to write this book is, you know, what it's like to watch your parents killed, what it's like to unearth bones of recently murdered opponents of a government or opponents of a guerrilla group. Was that much of a stretch for you to imagine these things?
It was a huge stretch, and it was also a terrible time to write this, you know, for me to write this book. It was not a book I enjoyed in any way. It sort of came out of necessity and in some way of responsibility to try and write about something, to give a portrait of a world that's so tragic, you know, and which we overlook from this distance in the West. It was really difficult to the point where, you know, at times I would just have to put the book away and have to kind of modify some of the violence, even though it's pretty bad.
How much time did you spend going back to Sri Lanka, where you were born, to see the impact of the civil war there?
Well, I've been going back there for the last... I've always gone back there, but in the last 7 years I've gone back about once a year for a couple of months each time. And, lived there. I didn't go out trying to hunt down the kind of stories. I was much more interested in kind of witnessing or listening to people talk about the situation of the war. You know, I didn't go there with a kind of documentary sense of trying to kind of ask specific questions or, you know, make judgments. I just wanted to kind of know what the life was like in a time of fear, in a time when so many people had lost relatives and lost in-laws.
We've had several people as guests on Fresh Air who do the kind of work your main characters do, disinterring bones and trying to analyze how the person was killed or executed and who might have been responsible for it. You also write about doctors who have to perform triage under horrible circumstances and watch treat babies who've been shot and victims of massacres. And I'm wondering what some of your thoughts ended up being about the type of person who can handle this professionally, the type of personality that can deal with disinterring mass graves or treating babies who were shot in war.
Well, I mean, I think, again, this is everyone has a different personality. I mean, what happened with this book was the character of Garmini, who is the doctor in the emergency services, is someone who has sort of embraced his work as a way of defense, really, and his whole life, his personal life, has kind of disappeared as a result. And when I was in Sri Lanka, I met a group of doctors, and wow, they were able to live normal lives. They could listen to cricket in the afternoons, or they would, you know, go drinking now and then. These people were stunningly dedicated. I don't think I've ever met people like this who really has kind of separated themselves from the government, from even the hospitals, and were kind of almost like roaming in packs, like samurai in a way, healing people. And these were remarkable individuals. They were in a world of their own making somehow. And at the same time, those who are doing forensic work and doing human rights work, whether it's in Sri Lanka or other parts of the world, there's this incredible, what was evident was that there's this incredible dedication and focus and detailed work, and yet at the same time, they need to go mad, in some way. In the book, they're all bowling, and they go bowling in the evenings and go quite wild. And there needs to be this escape in some way. There was even at one group I met who had invented the anthropologist's marching song, which they would sing when they were all drunk.
When you returned to Sri Lanka, did it cause you to wonder a lot what it would have been like for you if your family had stayed instead of leaving, and you would have been caught up in the tragedies that you were surrounded with there?
Well, I still do have family living there. I have a sister and various in-laws who still live there. So I'm very conscious of the presence of the war in Sri Lanka. And I don't know what would have happened if I had been there. It's very difficult to imagine it. But no, when you're there, what's interesting about it is when you go there, it's very much, I suppose, the way you discover Northern Ireland to be a place where you have a daily life, you have a civilization, you have people going to the stores and buying food, and good food, bad food, and I think that society continues on from a distance of, 2,000 miles. All you hear about is a bombing, so you imagine that is happening continuously. But it's one of those very strange 20th century things where a war goes on, and it goes on right alongside a civilization.
When you lived there, Sri Lanka was Ceylon, and it was still a colony. Where did your family fit in? What class were you in? What was your social status?
Well, I was a kid at that time. That was the last thing I thought about. But, my family had originally come from India in the 16th century, and they'd lived in Sri Lanka ever since then. So that there was a, they were, I think, originally Indian, and then they married Dutch, and then they married some English, and they married Sinhalese, and so it was a complete mixture of races. I suppose the average middle class family, really. And when I was a kid there, my father, and some of this comes out in Running the Family, became quite a serious alcoholic, so the kind of family fortune sort of dwindled. And then my parents broke up, and I went to England with my mother and a brother and a sister. So my father remained behind with one of his daughters. So that was the kind of history of the family. And really, when I go back now, it's really my sister and a few other friends I see. My father's dead now.
How did it affect your sense of identity to move to England and not be perhaps considered part of the mainstream there because you were... part Indian and part I forget the part Dutch, part, what are the other?
Part everything, really.
Part everything.
Well, you know, England was such a shock to me. I mean, I was 11 years old, and suddenly I was at a what was called a public school in England, which is like a private school here. And, you know, there were amazing number of rules and customs to quickly learn. And what happened was I really had to sort of forget my past in order to kind of cope with the present. But I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And it wasn't until I went to Canada in 63 or 64 that, you know, I went to university there and suddenly discovered English and writing and poetry. And that's when things changed for me. I think I was utterly lost as a teenager and then discovered art, which saved me, I guess.
My guest is Michael Ondaatje. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Michael Ondaatje is my guest. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. How did literature and movies in England compare to what you had been exposed to in Sri Lanka?
Well, I think in Sri Lanka, the main entertainment was conversation, you know, and there were very few books we read there. I mean, the tradition of writing was not too significant, you know, among people in my family, certainly. And, you know, I think huge rumors and stories at dinners were the main kind of literary force. But it was really in England that I became a reader, and that, of course, helped me later on in my writing.
Have you since discovered a poetry from Sri Lanka and the area around it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there's been a lot of literature, especially in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, about you know, some very good poetry. There was a poet called Lakdasa Wickramasinghe, who sadly died quite young, but he I think, was a major poet at the time. And I mean, I've been more interested in the literature of Sri Lanka, just reading even in the classical literature. There are two great ancient texts. One is called the Mahavamsa, one is called the Chulavamsa. And these are great, you know, myths and epics of the country.
When you started to read the great myths from Sri Lanka, did you understand anything about the culture that didn't make as much sense before?
Well, you know, it's like reading any kind of mythology or epic story. What is shocking and wonderful is that, first of all, you have a similar violence, you know, and at the same time, it's kind of this wonderful, intricate culture simultaneously, and it's almost like they go hand in hand. There's the old character Palipana, the archaeologist in this book, and he keeps talking about, in a way, trying to kind of not excuse the violence of the present, but trying to put into a context that this always happens. This always happens. You're going to get violence at certain moments, and we can do nothing about it. It's almost like a tradition. It's not a freak of nature. It's part of a tradition, and it's a very tough thing to accept. But this is what he sees. This historian sees.
Your novel, The English Patient, was incredibly successful, you know, a bestseller, then made into, you know, an Academy Award-winning movie. Did it make writing your new novel any easier or any more difficult?
I thought it would make it very difficult, but in fact it didn't seem to make much difference. I mean, I thought I was going to be so conscious of that freakish success, that I would not be able to kind of climb out from underneath that stone. But I began this book, Anil's Ghost. Well, I began with a series of writing poetry, and then Anil's Ghost about 1993, and really have been working on this book ever since, very slowly, because I work slowly. And I was sort of able to separate, you know, the sort of carnival that went with The English Patient, and working on this book quite privately, I was able to kind of, you know, block it off, I guess.
How did you separate the two?
I know. I just kind of, I think I'm quite schizophrenic in the way I can, you know, try and keep two things in my head at the same time. And I was just able to focus on this all that time while the rest of the thing was going on. I remember after the Academy Awards, I was in Guatemala, and there was, you know, I was talking to some people who were doing human rights work there. And it was only about two or three days after the Academy Awards. And even there, I was suddenly conscious of this huge gap in realities, you know. But
that is a really big gap.
It is a very big gap. But, you know, I think what happened was with the film, you know, the film had its own machinery, really. I mean, the actors were remarkable. They would go around talking about the film, and the film took off, and I really didn't have much to do with it, really. And so it looked like I was probably very busy at the time when I was busy with something else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Ondaatje. His new novel is called Anil's Ghost. He's also the author of The English Patient. The English Patient and Anil's Ghost are set during wars. Anil's Ghost is set in Sri Lanka during Civil War, and The English Patient was set during World War II in Europe. Have you ever been in war yourself?
No, I haven't. And, you know, I guess when I was growing up in England, there was a kind of awareness of the mythology of war. You know, I was in England in the 50s, and, you know, all the literature, all the films, all the, you know, radio shows seemed to be still reliving the adventures of the Second World War, you know, and various biographies. And I read all of these books and saw all those films. And but it was a war that in that kind of literature and art that seemed to be mostly about the English or the English and the Americans in the war. And so when I came, in fact, to write The English Patient, one of the things I discovered was the number of Asians, for instance, who were killed in the war as part of the Allied groups, you know, as well as Australians and others. And so I really wanted to try and redirect that kind of story to include people like Kip, who were there, and others. So although I haven't been part of a war, the mythology of that war certainly has been around me.
When you were growing up in England and watching movies about the war and reading books about the war and hearing stories told about the war, did you want a piece of it? Did you wish that you had experienced it? Or were you really grateful to grow up in times of peace?
Oh, I was grateful. I don't see any kind of joy in being in a war situation. I think that's crazy, you know, to want that.
You described yourself as a pacifist. But you're a pacifist who has been immersed in thinking about war for your last two novels.
I think I tend to write about what scares the hell out of me, actually, most of the time. It's not something I'm drawn to for pleasure, certainly. You know, especially this book, it was very difficult to kind of having to deal with all these stories. I mean, I have a lot of archival material that was given and got hold of, and from the civil rights movement and Penn, and from Amnesty, and also talking to people who had, you know, papers of the disappeared, letters from people who were writing letters to government officials about their son who had disappeared. I mean, these are absolutely tragic, tragic stories. And all these files were there, and I would just not want to read them, and I felt I had to read them. So it was something that I felt was in some ways something I had to do, and not that I wished to.
Why do you write about things that scare you?
I'm not quite sure. In a way, I suppose I write to try and get some order out of my life. You know, I mean, I think our lives are utterly chaotic and, you know, accidental. And I think, in a way, art does try and shape things and give you a kind of sense of order. Not that it is fully real or fully believable, but it's more believable than the false propaganda of government, certainly.
But, you know, to write this book, you not only had to imagine things, you had to go to places like Sri Lanka during war and travel around and see things. And so you were exposing yourself physically to the thing that scares you the most.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I didn't really feel in danger, but being exposed to that was bad enough.
Why would you want to put yourself through that?
Well, I think I wanted to write about it as truthfully and as intricately as I could. I didn't think I could write about it from a long way away. You know, it's not a question of judging people. It's a case of understanding how people are in a time of crisis. How does someone like Garmini survive working at those, you know, bizarre extremes of effort, you know, and what joy is there? Because there is a sort of kind of, there is a thrill there, not the kind of, you know, not the kind of Ernest Hemingway kind of thrill, but there is a thrill of having done something, and even if your own life is kind of become empty, that there is some satisfaction there. And in a way, perhaps that's the only way there's some kind of hope in this book or in this world, to have at least done something like this, which has been valid.
Michael Ndaje, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Ndaje's new novel is called Anil's Ghost. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.